The car was driving along a high ridge, overlooking a fast-moving river below. The river was almost enclosed by dense foliage on both sides. "There they are now," said the voice. "The animals you see are called Dilophosaurs." Despite what the recording said, Tim saw only one. The Dilophosaur crouched on its hind legs by the river, drinking. It was built on the basic carnivore pattern, with a heavy tail, strong hind limbs, and a long neck. Its 10-foot-tall body was spotted yellow and black like a leopard. But it was the head that held Tim's attention. Two broad, curving crests ran along the top of the head from the eyes to the nose. The crests met in the center, making a V-shape above the dinosaur's head. The crests had red and black stripes, reminiscent of a parrot or toucan. The animal gave a soft hooting cry, like an owl.
"They're pretty," Lex said.
"Dilophosaurus," the tape said, "is one of the earliest carnivorous dinosaurs. Scientists thought their jaw muscles were too weak to kill prey, and imagined they were primarily scavengers, but now we know they are poisonous." "Hey," Tim grinned, "all right." Again, the distinctive hooting call of the Dilophosaur drifted across the afternoon air toward them. Lex shifted uneasily in her seat.
"Are they really poisonous, Mr. Regis?"
"Don't worry about it," Ed Regis said.
"But are they?"
"Well, yes, Lex. Along with such living reptiles as Gila monsters and rattlesnakes, Dilophosaurus secretes a hematotoxin from glands in its mouth. Unconsciousness follows within minutes of a bite. The dinosaur will then finish the victim off at its leisure, making Dilophosaurus a beautiful but deadly addition to the animals you see here at Jurassic Park." The Land Cruiser turned a corner, leaving the river behind. Tim looked back, hoping for a last glimpse of the Dilophosaur. This was amazing. Poisonous dinosaurs. He wished he could stop the car, but everything was automatic. He bet Dr. Grant wanted to stop the car, too. "If you look on the bluff to the right, you'll see Les Gigantes, the site of our superb 3-star dining room. Chef Alain Richard hails from the world-famous Le Beau Manière in France. Make your reservations by dialing 4 from your hotel rooms." Tim looked up on the bluff and saw nothing.
Not for a while, though," Ed Regis said. "The restaurant won't even start construction until November."
"Continuing on our prehistoric safari, we come next to the herbivores of the Ornithischian group. If you look to your right, you can probably see them now." Tim saw two animals standing motionless in the shade of a large tree. Triceratops, the size and gray color of an elephant, with the truculent stance of a rhino. The horns above each eye curved 5 feet into the air, looking almost like inverted elephant tusks. A third rhino-like horn was located near the nose, and they had the beaky snout of a rhino. "Unlike other dinosaurs," the voice said, "Triceratops serratus can't see well. They're nearsighted, like the rhinos of today, and they tend to be surprised by moving objects. They'd charge our car if they were close enough to see it. But relax, folks. We're safe enough here. Triceratops have a fan-shaped crest behind their heads. It's made of solid bone, and it's very strong. These animals weigh about 7 tons each. Despite their appearance, they are actually quite docile. They know their handlers, and they'll allow themselves to be petted. They particularly like to be scratched in the hindquarters."
"Why don't they move?" Lex said. She rolled down her window. "Hey, stupid dinosaur, move!"
"Don't bother the animals, Lex," Ed Regis said.
"Why, it's stupid. They just sit there like a picture in a book," Lex said.
The voice was saying, "Easy going, monsters from a bygone world stand in sharp contrast to what we will see next. The most famous predator in the history of the world, the mighty tyrant lizard known as Tyrannosaurus Rex."
"Good. Tyrannosaurus Rex," Tim said.
"I hope he's better than these bozos," Lex said, turning away from the Triceratops. The Land Cruiser rumbled forward. Big Rex. The mighty Tyrannosaurs arose late in dinosaur history. Dinosaurs ruled the Earth for 120 million years, but there were Tyrannosaurs for only the last 15 million years of that period. The Land Cruisers had stopped at the rise of a hill.
They overlooked a forested area sloping down to the edge of the lagoon. The sun was falling to the west, sinking into a misty horizon. The whole landscape of Jurassic Park was bathed in soft light, with lengthening shadows. The surface of the lagoon rippled in pink crescents. Farther south, they saw the graceful necks of the apatosaurs standing at the water's edge, their bodies mirrored in the moving surface. It was quiet, except for the soft drone of cicadas. As they stared out at that landscape, it was possible to believe that they had really been transported millions of years back in time to a vanished world.
"It works, doesn't it?" they heard Ed Regis say over the intercom. "I like to come here sometimes in the evening and just sit."
Grant was unimpressed.
"Where is T-Rex?"
"Good question. You often see the little one down in the lagoon. The lagoon's stocked, so we have fish in there. The little one has learned to catch the fish. Interesting how he does it. He doesn't use his hands, but he ducks his whole head under the water like a bird."
"The little one?"
"The little T-Rex. He's a juvenile, 2 years old, and about a third grown now, stands 8 feet high, weighs a ton and a half. The other one's a full-grown tyrannosaur, but I don't see him at the moment."
"Maybe he's down hunting the apatosaurs," Grant said. Regis laughed, his voice tinny over the radio.
"He would if he could, believe me. Sometimes he stands by the lagoon and stares at those animals and wiggles those little forearms of his in frustration. But the T-Rex territory is completely enclosed with trenches and fences. They're disguised from view, but believe me, he can't go anywhere."
"Then where is he?"
"Hiding," Regis said. "He's a little shy."
"Shy?" Malcolm said. "Tyrannosaurus Rex is shy?"
"Well, he conceals himself as a general rule. You almost never see him out in the open, especially in daylight."
"Why is that?"
"We think it's because he has sensitive skin and sunburns easily."
Malcolm began to laugh. Grant sighed. "You're destroying a lot of illusions."
"I don't think you'll be disappointed," Regis said. "Just wait."
They heard a soft bleating sound. In the center of a field, a small cage rose up into view, lifted on hydraulics from underground. The cage bars slid down, and the goat remained tethered in the center of the field, bleating plaintively.
"Any minute now," Regis said again.
They stared out the window.
"Look at them," Hammond said, watching the control room monitor. "Leaning out of the window so eager, they can't wait to see it. They have come for the danger."
"That's what I'm afraid of," Muldoon said. He twirled the keys on his finger and watched the land cruisers tensely. This was the first time that visitors had toured Jurassic Park, and Muldoon shared Arnold's apprehension.
Robert Muldoon was a big man, 50 years old, with a steel-gray mustache and deep blue eyes. Raised in Kenya, he had spent most of his life as a guide for African big game hunters, as had his father before him. But since 1980, he had worked principally for conservation groups and zoo designers as a wildlife consultant. He had become well known. An article in the London Sunday Times had said, "What Robert Trent Jones is to golf courses, Robert Muldoon is to zoos, a designer of unsurpassed knowledge and skill." In 1986, he had done some work for a San Francisco company that was building a private wildlife park on an island in North America. Muldoon had laid out the boundaries for different animals, defining space and habitat requirements for lions, elephants, zebras, and hippos, identifying which animals could be kept together and which had to be separated. At the time, it had been a fairly routine job. He had been more interested in an Indian park called Tiger World in southern Kashmir. Then, a year ago, he was offered a job as game warden of Jurassic Park. It coincided with a desire to leave Africa. The salary was excellent. Muldoon had taken it on for a year. He was astonished to discover the park was really a collection of genetically engineered prehistoric animals. It was, of course, interesting work, but during his years in Africa, Muldoon had developed an unblinking view of animals, an unromantic view, that frequently set him at odds with the Jurassic Park management in California, particularly the little martinet standing beside him in the control room. In Muldoon's opinion, Cloning dinosaurs in a laboratory was one thing, maintaining them in the wild was quite another. It was Muldoon's view that some dinosaurs were too dangerous to be kept in a park setting. In part, the danger existed because they still knew so little about the animals. For example, nobody even suspected the Dilophosaurs were poisonous until they were observed hunting indigenous rats on the island, biting the rodents and then stepping back to wait for them to die. And even then, nobody suspected the Dilophosaurs could spit until one of the handlers was almost blinded by spitting venom. After that, Hammond had agreed to study Dilophosaur venom, which was found to contain 7 different toxic enzymes. It was also discovered that the Dilophosaurs could spit a distance of 50 feet. Since this raised the possibility that a guest in a car might be blinded, management decided to remove the poison sacs. The vets had tried twice on 2 different animals without success. No one knew where the poison was being secreted, and no one would ever know until an autopsy was performed on a Dilophosaur, and management would not allow one to be killed. Muldoon worried even more about the velociraptors. They were instinctive hunters, and they never passed up prey. They killed even when they weren't hungry. They killed for the pleasure of killing. They were swift, strong runners and astonishing jumpers. They had lethal claws on all 4 limbs. One swipe of a forearm would disembowel a man, spilling his guts out. And they had powerful, tearing jaws that ripped flesh instead of biting it. They were far more intelligent than the other dinosaurs, and they seemed to be natural cage breakers. Every zoo expert knew that certain animals were especially likely to get free of their cages. Some, like monkeys and elephants, could undo cage doors. Others, like wild pigs, were unusually intelligent and could lift gate fasteners with their snouts. But who would suspect that the giant armadillo was a notorious cage breaker? Or the moose? Yet a moose was almost as skillful with its snout as an elephant with its trunk. Moose were always getting free. They had a talent for it. And so did velociraptors. Raptors were at least as intelligent as chimpanzees. And like chimpanzees, they had agile hands that enabled them to open doors and manipulate objects. They could escape with ease. And when, as Muldoon had feared, one of them finally escaped, it killed 2 construction workers and maimed a 3rd before being recaptured. After that episode, the visitor lodge had been reworked with heavy barred gates, a high perimeter fence, and tempered glass windows, and the raptor holding pen was rebuilt with electronic sensors to warn of another impending escape. Muldoon wanted guns as well, and he wanted shoulder-mounted LAW missile launchers. Hunters knew how difficult it was to bring down a 4-ton African elephant, and some of the dinosaurs weighed 10 times as much. Management was horrified, insisting there be no guns anywhere on the island. When Muldoon threatened to quit and to take his story to the press, a compromise was reached. In the end, 2 specially built laser-guided missile launchers were kept in a locked room in the basement. Only Muldoon had keys to the room. Those were the keys Muldoon was twirling now.
"I'm going downstairs," he said.
Arnold, watching the control screens, nodded. The 2 Land Cruisers sat at the top of the hill, waiting for the T-Rex to appear.
"Hey," Dennis Nedry called from the far console, "as long as you're up, give me a Coke, okay?"
Grant waited in the car, watching quietly. The bleating of the goat became louder, more insistent. The goat tugged frantically at its tether, racing back and forth. Over the radio, Grant heard Lex say in alarm,
"What's going to happen to the goat? Is she going to eat the goat?"
"I think so," someone said to her, and then Ellie turned the radio down. Then they smelled the odor, a garbage stench of putrefaction and decay that drifted up the hillside toward them. Grant whispered, "He's here."
"She," Malcolm said.
The goat was tethered in the center of the field, 30 yards from the nearest trees. The dinosaur must be somewhere among the trees, but for a moment Grant could see nothing at all. Then he realized he was looking too low. The animal's head stood 20 feet above the ground, half concealed among the upper branches of the palm trees. Malcolm whispered, "Oh my God,
She's as large as a bloody building. Grant stared at the enormous square head, 5 feet long, mottled reddish-brown, with huge jaws and fangs. The Tyrannosaur's jaws worked once, opening and closing, but the huge animal did not emerge from hiding. Malcolm whispered, "How long will it wait?"
"Maybe 3 or 4 minutes. Maybe..."
The Tyrannosaur sprang silently forward, fully revealing her enormous body. In 4 bounding steps, she covered the distance to the goat, bent down, and bit it through the neck. The bleating stopped. There was silence. Poised over her kill, the Tyrannosaur became suddenly hesitant. Her massive head turned on the muscular neck, looking in all directions. She stared fixedly at the Land Cruiser high above on the hill. Malcolm whispered,
"Can she see us?"
"Oh, yes," Regis said on the intercom.
"Let's see if she's going to eat here in front of us, or if she's going to drag the prey away."
The Tyrannosaur bent down and sniffed the carcass of the goat. A bird chirped, her head snapped up, alert, watchful. She looked back and forth, scanning in small, jerking shifts.
"Like a bird," Ellie said.
Still the Tyrannosaur hesitated.
"What is she afraid of?"
Malcolm whispered.
"Probably another Tyrannosaur," Grant whispered. "Big carnivores like lions and tigers often became cautious after a kill, behaving as if suddenly exposed. 19th-century zoologists imagined the animals felt guilty for what they had done, but contemporary scientists documented the effort behind a kill, hours of patient stalking before the final lunge, as well as the frequency of failure. The idea of nature red in tooth and claw was wrong. Most often, the prey got away. When a carnivore finally brought down an animal, it was watchful for another predator who might attack it and steal its prize. Thus, this Tyrannosaur was probably fearful of another Tyrannosaur. The huge animal bent over the goat again. One great hind limb held the carcass in place as the jaws began to tear the flesh.
"She's going to stay," Regis whispered. "Excellent."
The Tyrannosaur lifted her head again, ragged chunks of bleeding flesh in her jaws. She stared at the Land Cruiser. She began to chew. They heard the sickening crunch of bones.
"Eww," Lex said over the intercom. "That's disgusting."
And then, as if caution had finally gotten the better of her, the Tyrannosaur lifted the remains of the goat in her jaws and carried them silently back among the trees.
"Ladies and gentlemen, Tyrannosaurus Rex," the tape said.
The Land Cruiser started up and moved silently off through the foliage. Malcolm sat back in his seat.
"Fantastic," he said.
Gennaro wiped his forehead. He looked pale. Control. Henry Wu came into the control room to find everyone sitting in the dark, listening to the voices on the radio.
"Jesus, if an animal like that gets out," Gennaro was saying, his voice tinny on the speaker, "there'd be no stopping it."
"No stopping it, no."
"Huge, with no natural enemies. My God, think of it."
In the control room, Hammond said, "Damn those people. They are so negative."
Wu said, "They're still going on about an animal escaping?
I don't understand. They must have seen by now that we have everything under control. We've engineered the animals and engineered the resort."
He shrugged. It was Wu's deepest perception that the park was fundamentally sound, as he believed his paleo DNA was fundamentally sound. Whatever problems might arise in the DNA were essentially point problems in the code, causing a specific problem in the phenotype, an enzyme that didn't switch on or a protein that didn't fold. Whatever the difficulty, it was always solved with a relatively minor adjustment in the next version. Similarly, he knew that Jurassic Park's problems were not fundamental problems. They were not control problems. Nothing as basic or as serious as the possibility of an animal escaping. Wu found it offensive to think that anyone would believe him capable of contributing to a system where such a thing could happen.
"It's that Malcolm," Hammond said darkly. "He's behind it all. He was against us from the start, you know. He's got his theory that complex systems can't be controlled and nature can't be imitated. I don't know what his problem is. Hell, we're just making a zoo here. World's full of them and they all work fine. But he's going to prove his theory or die trying.
I just hope he doesn't panic Gennaro into trying to shut the park down.
Wu said, can he do that?
No, Hammond said, but he can try. He can try and frighten the Japanese investors and get them to withdraw funds. Or he can make a stink with the San Jose government. He can make trouble. Arnold stubbed out his cigarette. Let's wait and see what happens, he said. We believe in the park. Let's see how it plays out. Muldoon got off the elevator, nodded to the ground floor guard, and went downstairs to the basement. He flicked on the lights. The basement was filled with 2 dozen Land Cruisers arranged in neat rows. These were the electric cars that would eventually form an endless loop, touring the park, returning to the visitor center. In the corner was a Jeep with a red stripe, one of 2 gasoline-powered vehicles. Harding, the vet, had taken the other that morning, which could go anywhere in the park, even among the animals. The Jeeps were painted with a diagonal red stripe because, for some reason, it discouraged the Triceratops from charging the car. Muldoon moved past the Jeep toward the back. The steel door to the armaments room was unmarked. He unlocked it with his key and swung the heavy door wide. Gun racks lined the interior. He pulled out a Randler's shoulder launcher and a case of canisters. He tucked 2 gray rockets under his other arm. After locking the door behind him, he put the gun into the back seat of the Jeep. As he left the garage, he heard the distant rumble of thunder. "Looks like rain," Ed Regis said, glancing up at the sky. The Land Cruisers had stopped again near the sauropod swamp. A large herd of apatosaurs was grazing at the edge of the lagoon, eating the leaves of the upper branches of the palm trees. In the same area were several duck-billed hadrosaurs, which in comparison looked much smaller. Of course, Tim knew the hadrosaurs weren't really small. It was only that the apatosaurs were so much larger. Their tiny heads reached 50 feet into the air, extending out on their long necks. "The big animals you see are commonly called Varanosaurus," the recording said, "but they are actually Apatosaurus. They weigh more than 30 tons. That means a single animal is as big as a whole herd of modern elephants. And you may notice that their preferred area, alongside the lagoon, is not swampy. Despite what the books say, Varanosaurs avoid swamps. They prefer dry land."
"Varanosaurus is the biggest dinosaur, Lex," Ed Regis said. Tim didn't bother to contradict him. Actually, Brachiosaurus was 3 times as large, and some people thought Ultrasaurus and Seismosaurus were even larger than Brachiosaurus. Seismosaurus might have weighed 100 tons. Alongside the apatosaurs, the smaller hadrosaurs stood on their hind legs to get at foliage. They moved gracefully for such large creatures. Several infant hadrosaurs scampered around the adults, eating the leaves that dropped from the mouths of the larger animals. "The dinosaurs of Jurassic Park don't breed," the recording said. "The young animals, you see, were introduced a few months ago, already hatched, but the adults nurture them anyway."
There was the rolling growl of thunder. The sky was darker, lower, and menacing.
"Yeah, looks like rain, all right," Ed Regis said.
The car started forward, and Tim looked back at the hadrosaurs. Suddenly, off to one side, he saw a pale yellow animal moving quickly. There were brownish stripes on its back. He recognized it instantly.
"Hey," he shouted, "stop the car!"
"What is it?" Ed Regis said.
"Quick, stop the car!"
"We move on now to see the last of our great prehistoric animals, the stegosaurs," the recorded voice said.
"What's the matter, Tim?" "I saw one! I saw one in the field out there!"
"Saw what?"
"A raptor in that field!"
"The stegosaurs are a mid-Jurassic animal, evolving about 170 million years ago," the recording said. "Several of these remarkable herbivores live here at Jurassic Park."
"Oh, I don't think so, Tim," Ed Regis said. "Not a raptor."
"I did! Stop the car!"
There was a babble on the intercom as the news was relayed to Grant and Malcolm.
"Tim says he saw a raptor."
"Where?"
"Back at the field."
"Let's go back and look."
"We can't go back," Ed Regis said.
"We can only go forward. The cars are programmed."
"We can't go back?" Grant said.
"No," Regis said. "Sorry. You see, it's kind of a ride."
"Tim, this is Professor Malcolm," said a voice cutting in on the intercom. "I have just one question for you about this raptor. How old would you say it was?
Older than the baby we saw today, Tim said, and younger than the big adults in the pen. The adults were 6 feet tall. This one was about half that size.
That's fine, Malcolm said.
I only saw it for a second, Tim said.
I'm sure it wasn't a raptor, Ed Regis said. It couldn't possibly be a raptor. Must have been one of the offies. They're always jumping their fences. We have a hell of a time with them.
I know I saw a raptor, Tim said.
I'm hungry,
Lex said. She was starting to whine. In the control room, Arnold turned to Wu.
What do you think the kid saw?
I think it must have been an offie.
Arnold nodded.
We have trouble tracking offies because they spend so much time in the trees.
The offies were an exception to the usual minute-to-minute control they maintained over the animals. The computers were constantly losing and picking up the offies as they went into the trees and then came down again.
What burns me, Hammond said, is that we have made this wonderful park, this fantastic park, and our very first visitors are going through it like accountants, just looking for problems. They aren't experiencing the wonder of it at all.
That's their problem, Arnold said. We can't make them experience wonder. The intercom clicked, and Arnold heard a voice drawl.
John, this is the NB over at the dock. We haven't finished offloading, but I'm looking at that storm pattern south of us. I'd rather not be tied up here if this chop gets any worse.
Arnold turned to the monitor showing the cargo vessel, which was moored at the dock on the east side of the island. He pressed the radio button.
How much left to do, Jim? Just the three final equipment containers. I haven't checked the manifest, but I assume you can wait another 2 weeks for it. We're not well berthed here, you know, and we're 100 miles offshore. You're requesting permission to leave?
Yes, John. I want that equipment, Hammond said. That's equipment for the labs. We need it.
Yes, Arnold said, but you didn't want to put money into a storm barrier to protect the pier, so we don't have a good harbor. If the storm gets worse, the ship will be pounded against the dock. I've seen ships lost that way. Then you've got all the other expenses, replacement of the vessel, plus salvage to clear your dock, and you can't use your dock until you do.
Hammond gave a dismissing wave.
Get them out of there.
Permission to leave, Anby, Arnold said into the radio. See you in 2 weeks, the voice said.
On the video monitor, they saw the crew on the decks, casting off the lines. Arnold turned back to the main console bank. He saw the land cruisers moving through fields of steam.
Where are they now? Hammond said.
It looks like the South Fields, Arnold said.
The southern end of the island had more volcanic activity than the north.
That means they should be almost to the Stegos. I'm sure they'll stop and see what Harding is doing.
Stegosaur. As the land cruiser came to a stop, Ellie Sattler stared through the plumes of steam at the Stegosaurus. It was standing quietly, not moving. A jeep with a red stripe was parked alongside it.
I have to admit, that's a funny-looking animal, Malcolm said.
The Stegosaurus was 20 feet long with a huge, bulky body and vertical armor plates along its back. The tail had dangerous-looking 3-foot spikes, but the neck tapered to an absurdly small head with a stupid gaze, like a very dumb horse. As they watched, a man walked around from behind the animal.
That's our vet, Dr. Harding, Regis said over the radio. He's anesthetized the Stego, which is why it's not moving. It's sick.
Grant was already getting out of the car, hurrying toward the motionless Stegosaur. Ellie got out and looked back as the second land cruiser pulled up and the two kids jumped out.
What's he sick with? Tim said. They're not sure, Ellie said.
The great leathery plates along the Stegosaur's spine drooped slightly. It breathed slowly, laboriously, making a wet sound with each breath.
Is it contagious? Lex said.
They walked toward the tiny head of the animal, where Grant and the vet were on their knees, peering into the Stegosaur's mouth. Lex wrinkled her nose.
This thing sure is big, she said, and smelly.
Yes, it is.
Ellie had already noticed the Stegosaur had a peculiar odor, like rotting fish. It reminded her of something she knew, but couldn't quite place. In any case, she had never smelled a Stegosaur before. Maybe this was its characteristic odor. But she had her doubts. Most herbivores did not have a strong smell, nor did their droppings. It was reserved for the meat-eaters to develop a real stink.
"Is that because it's sick?"
Lex asked.
"Maybe. And don't forget the vets tranquilized it."
"Ellie, have a look at this tongue," Grant said. The dark purple tongue drooped limply from the animal's mouth. The vet shone a light on it so she could see the very fine silvery blisters.
"Microvesicles," Ellie said. "Interesting."
"We've had a difficult time with these stegos," the vet said. "They're always getting sick."
"But what are the symptoms?" Ellie asked.
She scratched the tongue with her fingernail. A clear liquid exuded from the broken blisters.
"Ugh," Lex said.
"Imbalance, disorientation, labored breathing, and massive diarrhea," Harding said. "Seems to happen about once every 6 weeks or so."
"They feed continuously?"
"Oh, yes," Harding said. "Animal this size has to take in a minimum of 500 or 600 pounds of plant matter daily just to keep going. They're constant foragers."
"Then it's not likely to be poisoning from a plant," Ellie said.
"Constant browsers would be constantly sick if they were eating a toxic plant, not every 6 weeks."
"Exactly," the vet said. "May I?" Ellie asked.
She took the flashlight from the vet.
"You have pupillary effects from the tranquilizer," she said, shining the light in the stegosaur's eye.
"Yes, there's a meiotic effect. Pupils are constricted."
"But these pupils are dilated," she said.
Harding looked. There was no question. The stegosaur's pupil was dilated and did not contract when light shone on it.
"I'll be damned," he said. "That's a pharmacological effect."
"Yes."
Ellie got back on her feet and looked around.
"What is the animal's range?"
"About 5 square miles.
"In this general area?" she asked.
They were in an open meadow with scattered rocky outcrops and intermittent plumes of steam rising from the ground. It was late afternoon, and the sky was pink beneath the lowering gray clouds. "The range is mostly north and east of here," Harding said, "but when they get sick, they're usually somewhere around this particular area." It was an interesting puzzle, she thought. How to explain the periodicity of the poisoning? She pointed across the field.
"You see those low, delicate-looking bushes?"
"West Indian lilac," Harding nodded. "We know it's toxic. The animals don't eat it."
"You're sure?"
"Yes, we monitor them on video, and I've checked droppings, just to be certain. The stegos never eat the lilac bushes." Melia azedarach, called chinaberry or West Indian lilac, contained a number of toxic alkaloids. The Chinese use the plant as a fish poison. "They don't eat it," the vet said.
"Interesting," Ellie said, "because otherwise I would have said that this animal shows all the classic signs of Melia toxicity. Stupor, blistering of the mucous membranes, and pupillary dilatation."
She set off toward the field to examine the plants more closely, her body bent over the ground.
"You're right," she said. "Plants are healthy, no sign of being eaten, none at all."
"And there's the 6 week interval," the vet reminded her.
"The stegosaurs come here how often?"
"About once a week," he said. "Stegos make a slow loop through their home range territory, feeding as they go. They complete the loop in about a week."
"But they're only sick once every 6 weeks."
"Correct," Harding said.
"This is boring,"
Lex said.
"Shh," Tim said. "Dr. Sattler's trying to think."
Unsuccessfully, Ellie said, walking farther out into the field. Behind her, she heard Lex saying,
"Anybody want to play a little pickle?"
Ellie stared at the ground. The field was rocky in many places. She could hear the sound of the surf somewhere to the left. There were berries among the rocks. Perhaps the animals were just eating berries, but that didn't make sense. West Indian lilac berries were terribly bitter.
"Finding anything?" Grant said, coming up to join her.
Ellie sighed.
"Just rocks," she said. "We must be near the beach, because all these rocks are smooth, and they're in funny little piles."
"Funny little piles?" Grant said.
"All over. There's one pile right there," she pointed.
As soon as she did, she realized what she was looking at. The rocks were worn, but it had nothing to do with the ocean. These rocks were piled in small piles, almost as if they had been thrown down that way. They were piles of gizzard stones. Many birds and crocodiles swallowed small stones, which collected in a muscular pouch in the digestive tract called the gizzard.
Squeezed by the muscles of the gizzard, the stones helped crush tough plant food before it reached the stomach, and thus aided digestion. Some scientists thought dinosaurs also had gizzard stones. For one thing, dinosaur teeth were too small and too little worn to have been used for chewing food. It was presumed that dinosaurs swallowed their food whole and let the gizzard stones break down the plant fibers. And some skeletons had been found with an associated pile of small stones in the abdominal area, but it had never been verified, and gizzard stones, Grant said.
I think so, yes. They swallow these stones, and after a few weeks the stones are worn smooth. So they regurgitate them, leaving this little pile, and swallow fresh stones. And when they do, they swallow berries as well and get sick.
I'll be damned, Grant said. I'm sure you're right. He looked at the pile of stones, brushing through them with his hand, following the instinct of a paleontologist. Then he stopped. Ellie, he said, take a look at this.
Put it there, babe, right in the old mitt,
Lex cried, and Gennaro threw the ball to her. She threw it back so hard that his hands stung.
Take it easy, I don't have a glove.
You wimp,
she said contemptuously. Annoyed, he fired the ball at her and heard it smack in the leather.
Now that's more like it, she said.
Standing by the dinosaur, Gennaro continued to play catch as he talked to Malcolm. How does this sick dinosaur fit into your theory?
It's predicted, Malcolm said.
Gennaro shook his head.
Is anything not predicted by your theory?
Look, Malcolm said, it's nothing to do with me. It's chaos theory. But I notice nobody is willing to listen to the consequences of the mathematics, because they imply very large consequences for human life. Much larger than Heisenberg's principle or Gödel's theorem, which everybody rattles on about. Those are actually rather academic considerations, philosophical considerations. But chaos theory concerns everyday life. Do you know why computers were first built?
No, Gennaro said.
Burn it in there,
Lex yelled. Computers were built in the late 1940s because mathematicians like John von Neumann thought that if you had a computer, a machine to handle a lot of variables simultaneously, you would be able to predict the weather. Weather would finally fall to human understanding, and men believed that dream for the next 40 years. They believed that prediction was just a function of keeping track of things. If you knew enough, you could predict anything. That's been a cherished scientific belief since Newton.
And?
Chaos theory throws it right out the window. It says that you can never predict certain phenomena at all. You can never predict the weather more than a few days away. All the money that has been spent on long-range forecasting, about $500 million in the last few decades, is money wasted. It's a fool's errand. It's as pointless as trying to turn lead into gold. We look back at the alchemists and laugh at what they were trying to do, but future generations will laugh at us the same way. We've tried the impossible and spent a lot of money doing it. Because, in fact, there are great categories of phenomena that are inherently unpredictable.
Chaos says that?
Yes.
And it is astonishing how few people care to hear it, Malcolm said. I gave all this information to Hammond long before he broke ground on this place. You're going to engineer a bunch of prehistoric animals and set them on an island? Fine. A lovely dream. Charming. But it won't go as planned. It is inherently unpredictable. Just as the weather is.
You told him this?
Gennaro said.
Yes.
I also told him where the deviations would occur. Obviously, the fitness of the animals to the environment was one area. This stegosaur is 100 million years old. It isn't adapted to our world. The air is different, the solar radiation is different, the land is different, the insects are different, the sounds are different, the vegetation is different, everything is different. The oxygen content is decreased. This poor animal's like a human being at 10,000 feet altitude. Listen to him wheezing.
And the other areas?
Broadly speaking, the ability of the park to control the spread of life forms, because the history of evolution is that life escapes all barriers. Life breaks free. Life expands to new territories. Painfully, perhaps even dangerously, but life finds a way. Malcolm shook his head.
I don't mean to be philosophical, but there it is.
Gennaro looked over. Ellie and Grant were across the field, waving their arms and shouting.
Did you get my coke?
Dennis Nedry asked as Muldoon came back into the control room. Muldoon didn't bother to answer. He went directly to the monitor and looked at what was happening. Over the radio, we heard Harding's voice saying,
Astego, finally, handle on now.
What's that about? Muldoon said.
They're down by the South Point, Arnold said. That's why they're breaking up a little. I'll switch them to another channel. But, they found out what's wrong with the Stegos, eating some kind of berry.
Hammond nodded.
I knew we'd solve that sooner or later, he said.
It's not very impressive, Gennaro said.
He held the white fragment, no larger than a postage stamp, up on his fingertip in the fading light.
You sure about this, Alan?
Absolutely sure, Grant said. What gives it away is the patterning on the interior surface, the interior curve. Turn it over and you will notice a faint pattern of raised lines, making roughly triangular shapes.
Yes, I see them.
Well, I've dug out two eggs with patterns like that at my site in Montana.
You're saying this is a piece of dinosaur eggshell?
Absolutely, Grant said. Harding shook his head. These dinosaurs can't breed.
Evidently they can, Gennaro said.
That must be a bird egg, Harding said. We have literally dozens of species on the island. Grant shook his head. Look at the curvature. The shell is almost flat. That's from a very big egg. And notice the thickness of the shell. Unless you have ostriches on this island, it's a dinosaur egg.
But they can't possibly breed, Harding insisted. All the animals are female.
All I know, Grant said, is that this is a dinosaur egg.
Malcolm said, Can you tell the species?
Yes, Grant said. It's a velociraptor egg.
Control.
Absolutely absurd, Hammond said in the control room, listening to the report over the radio. It must be a bird egg. That's all it can be.
The radio crackled. He heard Malcolm's voice.
Let's do a little test, shall we? Ask Mr. Arnold to run one of his computer tallies. Now? Yes, right now. I understand you can transmit it to the screen in Dr. Harding's car. Do that, too, will you?
No problem, Arnold said. A moment later, the screen in the control room printed out the same list as before of the total animal numbers in the park. There was no change in the figures.
I hope you're satisfied, Hammond said. Are you receiving it down there on your screen?
We see it, Malcolm said.
Everything accounted for, as always.
He couldn't keep the satisfaction out of his voice.
Now then, Malcolm said, can you have the computer search for a different number of animals?
Like what? Arnold said.
Try 239.
Just a minute, Arnold said, frowning.
A moment later, the screen printed the list again. Above the list, the total number of animals was now given as 239. At the bottom of the list, the totals now read, Expected animals, 238. Found animals, 239. The list itself was unchanged, except for the number of found procompsognathids.
Hammond sat forward. What the hell is that?
We picked up another compy.
From where?
I don't know.
The radio crackled. Now then, can you ask the computer to search for, let us say, 300 animals?
What is he talking about?
Hammond said, his voice rising.
300 animals? What's he talking about?
Just a minute, Arnold said. That'll take a few minutes. He pushed buttons on the screen. The first line of the totals appeared. Total animals, 239.
I don't understand what he's driving at, Hammond said.
I'm afraid I do, Arnold said. He watched the screen. The numbers on the first line were clicking. Total animals, 244.
244?
Hammond said.
What's going on?
The computer is counting the animals in the park, Wu said. All the animals.
I thought that's what it always did.
He spun.
Nedry, have you screwed up again?
No, Nedry said, looking up from his console.
Computer allows the operator to enter an expected number of animals in order to make the counting process faster, but it's a convenience, not a flaw.
He's right, Arnold said. We just always used the base count of 238 because we assumed there couldn't be more.
Total animals, 262.
Wait a minute, Hammond said. These animals can't breed. The computer must be counting field mice or something.
I think so, too, Arnold said. It's almost certainly an error in the visual tracking. But we'll know soon enough.
Hammond turned to Wu. They can't breed, can they?
No, Wu said. Total animals, 270.
Where are they coming from?
Arnold said. Damned if I know, Wu said. They watched the numbers climb. Total animals, 283. Over the radio, they heard Gennaro say,
Holy shit, how much more?
And they heard the girl say,
I'm getting hungry. When are we going home?
Pretty soon, Lex. On the screen, there was a flashing error message. Error, search parameters, 300 animals not found.
An error, Hammond said, nodding. I thought so. I had the feeling all along there must be an error.
But a moment later, the screen printed, Total animals, 292. Tyrannosaurs expected, 2. Found, 2. Version 4.1. Myosaurs expected, 21. Found, 22. Version unknown. Stegosaurs expected, 4. Found, 4. Version 3.9. Triceratops expected, 8. Found, 8. Version 3.1. Procompsognathids expected, 49. Found, 65. Version unknown. Othnelia expected, 16. Found, 23. Version unknown. Velociraptors expected, 8. Found, 37. Version unknown. Apatosaurs expected, 17. Found, 17. Version 3.1. Hadrosaurs expected, 11. Found, 11. Version 3.1. Dilophosaurs expected, 7. Found, 7. Version 4.3. Pterosaurs expected, 6. Found, 6. Version 4.3. Hypsilophodontids expected, 33. Found, 34. Version unknown. Euplocephalids expected, 16. Found, 16. Version 4.0. Styracosaurs expected, 18. Found, 18. Version 3.9. Microceratops expected, 22. Found, 22. Version 4.1. Total expected, 238. Total found, 292. The radio crackled.
Now you see the flaw in your procedures, Malcolm said. You only track the expected number of dinosaurs. You were worried about losing animals, and your procedures were designed to advise you instantly if you had less than the expected number, but that wasn't the problem. The problem was you had more than the expected number.
Christ, Arnold said. There can't be more, Wu said. We know how many we've released. There can't be more than that.
Afraid so, Henry, Malcolm said. They're breeding.
No!
Even if you don't accept Grant's eggshell, you can prove it with your own data. Take a look at the Compy height graph. Arnold will put it up for you.
Arnold did so, and they saw the same smooth single curve as before, the heights peaking at 33 and 34 centimeters.
Notice anything about it? Malcolm said.
It's a Poisson distribution, Wu said. Normal curve.
But didn't you say you introduced the Compies in 3 batches at 6-month intervals?
Yes.
Then you should get a graph with peaks for each of the 3 separate batches that were introduced, Malcolm said, tapping the keyboard. Like this. A new graph appeared showing an uneven curve with 3 peaks at 26, 33, and 38 centimeters.
But you didn't get this graph, Malcolm said. The graph you actually got is a graph of a breeding population. Your compies are breeding.
Wu shook his head. I don't see how.
They're breeding, and so are the Othnelia, the Myosaurs, the Hypsies, and the Velociraptors.
Christ, Muldoon said. There are raptors free in the park.
Well, it's not that bad, Hammond said, looking at the screen. We have increases in just 3 categories. Well, 5 categories. Very small increases in 2 of them.
What are you talking about? Wu said loudly. Don't you know what this means?
Of course I know what this means, Henry, Hammond said. It means you screwed up.
Absolutely not.
You've got breeding dinosaurs out there, Henry.
But they're all female, Wu said. It's impossible. There must be a mistake. And look at the numbers. A small increase in the big animals, the myosaurs and the hipsies, and big increases in the number of small animals. It just doesn't make sense. It must be a mistake.
The radio clicked.
Actually, not, Grant said. I think these numbers confirm that breeding is taking place in 7 different sites around the island. Breeding sites.
The sky was growing darker. Thunder rumbled in the distance. Grant and the others leaned in the doors of the jeep, staring at the screen on the dashboard.
Breeding sites?
Wu said over the radio.
Nests, Grant said. Assuming the average clutches 8 to 12 hatching eggs, these data would indicate the compies have 2 nests. The raptors have 2 nests, the Authies have 1 nest, and the Hipsies and the Mayas have 1 nest each.
Where are these nests?
We'll have to find them, Grant said. Dinosaurs build their nests in secluded places.
But why are there so few big animals, Wu said. If there is a Maya nest of 8 to 12 eggs, there should be 8 to 12 new Mayas, not just 1.
That's right, Grant said. Except that the raptors and the compies that are loose in the park are probably eating the eggs of the bigger animals, and perhaps eating the newly hatched young as well.
But we've never seen that, Arnold said over the radio. Raptors are nocturnal, he said. Is anyone watching the park at night?
There was a long silence.
I didn't think so, Grant said. It still doesn't make sense, Wu said. You can't support 50 additional animals on a couple of nests of eggs.
No, Grant said. I assume they are eating something else as well. Perhaps small rodents, mice and rats. There was another silence.
Let me guess, Grant said. When you first came to the island, you had a problem with rats. But as time passed, the problem faded away.
Yes, that's true. And you never thought to investigate why?
Well, we just assumed, Arnold said. Look, Wu said, the fact remains all the animals are female. They can't breed.
Grant had been thinking about that. He had recently learned of an intriguing West German study that he suspected held the answer.
When you made your dinosaur DNA, Grant said, you were working with fragmentary pieces, is that right?
Yes, Wu said.
In order to make a complete strand, were you ever required to include DNA fragments from other species?
Occasionally, yes, Wu said. It's the only way to accomplish the job. Sometimes we included avian DNA from a variety of birds, and sometimes reptilian DNA.
Any amphibian DNA, specifically frog DNA?
Possibly, I'd have to check.
Check, Grant said. I think you'll find that holds the answer.
Malcolm said, frog DNA? Why frog DNA?
Gennaro said impatiently, listen, this is all very intriguing, but we're forgetting the main question. Have any animals gotten off the island?
Grant said, we can't tell from these data.
Then how are we going to find out?
There's only one way I know, Grant said. We'll have to find the individual dinosaur nests, inspect them, and count the remaining egg fragments. From that, we may be able to determine how many animals were originally hatched, and we can begin to assess whether any are missing.
Malcolm said, even so, you won't know if the missing animals are killed or dead from natural causes, or whether they have left the island.
No, Grant said, but it's a start, and I think we can get more information from an intensive look at the population graphs.
How are we going to find these nests?
Actually, Grant said, I think the computer will be able to help us with that.
Can we go back now? Lex said. I'm hungry.
Yes, let's go, Grant said, smiling at her. You've been very patient.
You'll be able to eat in about 20 minutes, Ed Regis said, starting toward the 2 land cruisers.
I'll stay for a while, Ellie said, and get photos of the stego with Dr. Harding's camera. Those vesicles in the mouth will have cleared up by tomorrow.
I want to get back, Grant said. I'll go with the kids.
I will too, Malcolm said.
I think I'll stay, Gennaro said, and go back with Harding in his jeep, with Dr. Sattler.
Fine, let's go.
They started walking. Malcolm said,
why exactly is our lawyer staying?
Grant shrugged. I think it might have something to do with Dr. Sattler.
Really?
The shorts, you think?
It's happened before, Grant said.
When they came to the land cruisers, Tim said, I want to ride in the front one this time with Dr. Grant.
Malcolm said, unfortunately, Dr. Grant and I need to talk.
I'll just sit and listen. I won't say anything, Tim said.
It's a private conversation, Malcolm said.
Tell you what, Tim, Ed Regis said, let them sit in the rear car by themselves. We'll sit in the front car, and you can use the night vision goggles. Have you ever used night vision goggles, Tim? They're goggles with very sensitive CCDs that allow you to see in the dark.
Neat, he said,
and moved toward the first car.
Hey, Lex said, I want to use it too.
No, Tim said.
No fair, no fair. You get to do everything, Timmy.
Ed Regis watched them go and said to Grant, I can see what the ride back is going to be like.
Grant and Malcolm climbed into the second car. A few raindrops spattered the windshield.
Let's get going, Ed Regis said. I'm about ready for dinner, and I could do with a nice banana daiquiri.
What do you say, folks? Daiquiri sound good?
He pounded the metal panel of the car.
See you back at camp, he said,
and he started running toward the first car and climbed aboard. A red light on the dashboard blinked. With a soft electric whirr, the Land Cruisers started off. Driving back in the fading light, Malcolm seemed oddly subdued. Grant said, you must feel vindicated about your theory. As a matter of fact, I'm feeling a bit of dread. I suspect we are at a very dangerous point.
Why?
Intuition.
Do mathematicians believe in intuition?
Absolutely. Very important intuition. Actually, I was thinking of fractals, Malcolm said. Do you know about fractals?
Grant shook his head. Not really, no.
Fractals are a kind of geometry associated with a man named Mandelbrot. Unlike ordinary Euclidean geometry that everybody learns in school, squares and cubes and spheres, fractal geometry appears to describe real objects in the natural world. Mountains and clouds are fractal shapes. So fractals are probably related to reality, somehow. Well, Mandelbrot found a remarkable thing with his geometric tools. He found that things looked almost identical at different scales.
At different scales? Grant said.
For example, Malcolm said, a big mountain seen from far away has a certain rugged mountain shape. If you get closer and examine a small peak of the big mountain, it will have the same mountain shape. In fact, you can go all the way down the scale to a tiny speck of rock seen under a microscope. It will have the same basic fractal shape as the big mountain.
I don't really see why this is worrying you, Grant said. He yawned. He smelled the sulfur fumes of the volcanic steam. They were coming now to the section of road that ran near the coastline, overlooking the beach and the ocean.
It's a way of looking at things, Malcolm said. Mandelbrot found a sameness from the smallest to the largest, and this sameness of scale also occurs for events.
Events?
Consider cotton prices, Malcolm said. There are good records of cotton prices going back more than 100 years. When you study fluctuations in cotton prices, you find that the graph of price fluctuations in the course of a day looks basically like the graph for a week, which looks basically like the graph for a year or for 10 years. And that's how things are. A day is like a whole life. You start out doing one thing, but end up doing something else. Plan to run an errand, but never get there. And at the end of your life, your whole existence has that same haphazard quality, too. Your whole life has the same shape as a single day.
I guess it's one way to look at things, Grant said.
No, Malcolm said, it's the only way to look at things, at least the only way that is true to reality. You see, the fractal idea of sameness carries within it an aspect of recursion, a kind of doubling back on itself, which means that events are unpredictable, that they can change suddenly and without warning.
Okay. But we have soothed ourselves into imagining sudden change as something that happens outside the normal order of things, an accident like a car crash, or beyond our control like a fatal illness. We do not conceive of sudden radical irrational change as built into the very fabric of existence, yet it is. And chaos theory teaches us, Malcolm said, that straight linearity, which we have come to take for granted in everything from physics to fiction, simply does not exist. Linearity is an artificial way of viewing the world. Real life isn't a series of interconnected events occurring one after another like beads strung on a necklace. Life is actually a series of encounters in which one event may change those that follow.